This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, in the week when two founder members of the Football League went head-to-head. Between them, Blackburn Rovers and Preston North End have a combined existence of 287 years and 246 seasons. I don't have a figure for their total number of managers in that time, but it's now plus one, with Preston's Frankie McAvoy sacked in the aftermath of a Blackburn victory. Meanwhile, there's also a managerial movement in Sky Bet League One, as despite winning half his matches over the past 3 months, Ipswich Town parted company with Paul Cook. They've replaced him on an interim basis with former player and former Colchester United manager John McCreel, who only arrived back at Portman Road 48 hours earlier to work with some of the club's development squads. Sadly, the other off-the-field news from the EFL this week is truly tragic. Football has been shocked by the passing at the age of just 38 of Marvin Morgan. He made more than 200 career league appearances, notably for Aldershot Town, Shrewsbury Town and Plymouth Argyle. And since his retirement, had been building his own fashion wear business. It's the official EFL podcast. So in the Skybet Championship, crisis what crisis for Sheffield United and Middlesbrough, with both their respective new managers, Paul Heckingbottom and Chris Wilder, securing a second successive win to take them both within 5 points of the playoffs. That Blackburn Rovers victory was their sixth in eight, with a 7-0 thrashing at the hands of Fulham in the middle of that run. Fulham themselves remain on top of the pack after a 1-1 draw with second place Bournemouth. We can speak to club captain Tom Kearney. And I sense a little frustration personally, Tom, because it's not quite been the start of the season you would have hoped for with injury. And were you one of the ones that got ill as well?
Yeah, I did. The injury is more frustrating than the illness, but we had a big virus through the camp, and I was the one who I missed two games, Derby and Preston, two draws, yeah.
And that was the obvious illness, the illness that's been, you know, sweeping through the planet for the last, God knows, nearly 2 years now.
No, it wasn't the big one. It was non-COVID related.
Okay, so that was a challenging week running up to the Bournemouth game. But generally speaking, from your own personal point of view, I guess a little bit bittersweet has it been? Because on the one hand, the boys are doing great. On the other hand, it's taken you a while to fully get involved.
Yeah, I mean, it's, to be honest, I'm just happy to feel like a footballer again. I mean, I missed a lot of last season, which was really, really frustrating. And in that, I seen my team get relegated. So it's frustrating that you can't do anything about it or affect it. But it's just football, I suppose. But I'm happy to be back playing, back amongst it, contributing, came on the other night. And yeah, but at the same time, we've got a very, very good squad and we're top of the league. So it's enjoyable.
Yeah. Is it bittersweet, though? I mean, you know, it's a conversation I always want to have with footballers, because of course you love your football club. Of course, you've been there since 2015. But the longer you're out, I guess, and the team do well, the harder it is always going to be to get back in.
Yeah, it is. But I'd rather it be that way than like it was last season. I mean, being injured and your team near the bottom of the league is harder than being injured and seeing your team at the top of the league. Honestly, it is. So, yeah, I mean, competition for place is what you want, because it means you're in a strong squad and you're in a good position. So that's definitely what we've got here. I honestly think we could play two strong starting 11s in the championship. I really do. There's people that don't even make the bench that you could argue could start in a lot of championship teams.
Yeah. When I look at your time with the club, particularly the last five seasons, so miss out in the playoffs, win the playoffs, somebody scored a particularly important goal, relegated, promoted via the playoffs, relegate. That is
some
a lot
drama.
An emotional roller coaster. I was trying to avoid saying the word roller coaster, but how on earth do you deal with that level of contrast?
I don't know. It's just full of drama. I think Fulham is just a bit like that. Well, exactly. Since I've been here, I mean, you just described it very well. I mean, and now we're in a race to get promoted again. So it's much of the same, really. So I hope that we can get promoted this season, have a bit of drama, obviously. And then next season, it can just be like mid-table, just a little bit less stress.
Do you in any way fear promotion because of that gap? Because your past experiences have suggested that you will struggle the next season. Does any footballer ever fear promotion?
No, I don't think so. I don't fear promotion, but I'm coming at the same time. I'm totally aware of what's coming the season after. Do you know what I mean? But I truly, truly feel you just have to stay up that one season, like Villa did on the last day or whatever. And I feel like if Fulham do that, if we do that, I feel like we'll be a Premier League team for a long, long time. I just feel like you just need that 1 year to establish yourself. Then you get new promoted teams that are obviously going to be struggling a little bit, and then we can attract players. We're a London club. It is geared to go. We've got a new stadium, a new stand that makes a new stadium, but I mean, we are geared to be a Premier League and be in Premier League for a long time. I truly believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to imagine you on a Saturday night and family, those you live with, the contrast between being a player that's on top of the world, great momentum like the club's just had, winning 7 in a row, the not winning anything like as regularly. That's a different person going home, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, it is. It's hard not to take results, performances home with you. It is hard. I mean, I think it lasts 2 or 3 days normally. The good thing about the Championship is you always get like a midweek game, really, to get it out of the system. But with the Premier League, sometimes you don't play for a week or 9 days. They change the fixtures a lot. Saturday, then you might not play till the following Monday night. It's a long time when you're losing. It really is. And the training ground can be a bit of a down place, as I say. So, it's contrasting emotions from last season to this season.
Yeah. Just can you put into words just how big the gap is between the Championship and the Premier League?
Yeah, it's obviously big. Is the top of the Championship and the bottom 4 or 5 of the Premier League massive? Maybe not. Do you know what I mean? But I'd say, I was watching Monday Night Football last night, and I think Gary Neville said, I think the difference between the top 6, top 8, and the rest of the Premier League is quite a lot. Do you know what I mean? So you very rarely see a bottom 5, bottom 6 team go and take points off the likes of Man U, Man City, etc. But at the same time, the Premier League, you want that because the Premier League is the best league in the world for a reason, and it's got the best managers now and the best players. So that's where you want to be.
And just to sort of bottom personal emotions and all this stuff, do you meditate? Do you do a bit of mindfulness? Have you got your own personal kind of routines that help stabilize you? Because in everyday life, probably, people you see in the street going about everyday professions probably couldn't cope with that diversity of contrast.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that. I think psychology is a massive thing. The mental side of football is big. I think everyone has their own ways of dealing with things. I don't meditate or anything like that, but I think I've been in the game a long time now, seeing a lot of ups and downs, and I just try and get it out of my system as fast as possible, really. I'd probably say that last year was the hardest year of my career, really, with the injury. So anything after that, I feel like I can deal with.
Yeah. And listen, you've been very clear since the start. I love when I delve into your story, the 2 weeks work experience you did in a bank, which set you on direction to knowing you had to be a professional footballer. There's no way you wanted that poorly tied tie around your neck and all the rest of it.
Yeah, the Barclays Bank 2 weeks was a bad, bad time in my life.
Yeah, what? Worse than being injured last season?
It was close. Just catching the school bus and going to Barclays Bank was awful. But all my eggs was in one basket, and thankfully it paid off.
Yeah, and then of course there was the rejection by Leeds United as well, because this 6-foot bloke now was a tiddler at the time. They didn't think you were tall enough.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I suppose, actually, looking back, that was a hard time as well, from being at Leeds from 7 till 16, hardly ever missing a training session, gave the club my everything, loved the club, and to get released at 16 was hard. I mean, it's like a crossroads in your life, isn't it? I mean, you have friends, you have school, you have, like distractions. So it's to have your world come crushing down, all you've ever known at that age, is difficult. And I feel like it happens to a lot of boys, a hell of a lot of boys every year. And maybe there's not enough help, really, of the mental side of it. I think it helps if you've got a strong family around you and stuff like that. And I did have that. And I went and started a different journey at Hull, and thankfully it all paid off.
Yeah. Did you at any point contemplate at that point that you might not have a career as a professional footballer? Were you starting to think about having to move into the real world?
No, I don't think I was. I think that's no. I always believed when I did catch up physically, body wise, and it'd go back to football ability again. And I was always one of the best in my academy team, but then I fell behind because I was a bit of a little boy playing against adolescent men. And that was just the case. And in the 2 years I grew, I developed at Hull and made my Premier League debut, I think 2.5 years later.
I realise some of my questions have sounded like a sort of psychology session and stuff like that. But do you allow yourself a little bit of self-praise, of self-love when you contrast what you have achieved?
I think life's in football so fast, I don't think you get a chance to look back. Maybe it's always the next thing, the next game, the next training session, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe when I finish or when I come to the end, I'll maybe look back. But people like my family remind me sometimes of how well I've done and how far I've come. So, but I think I don't like to dwell on it a little bit. I like to keep on going. Maybe at the end I'll look back and think, yeah, I did okay.
Yeah, but keeps you going as well, doesn't it, in those darker, more challenging moments like the one you've described last season?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, listen, there's not many people's careers or moments through football that are just like that. Maybe Wayne Rooney or like the odd people that just keep going up and up and up. But on the whole, footballers in general, it's a little bit up and down. And yeah, I'm no different. And yeah, it definitely helps you in the bad times.
Yeah, and I'm delving because obviously society as a whole has had its challenges over the past 18 months, 20 months, as a lot of people have been kicked when they were down. So to hear the inspiring side of your story is exactly that. What about adapting to different managers then? First one, the one that brought you in was Slav?
Kit Simons.
Kit Simons, Slav, Claudio Ranieri, Scott Parker, now you've got Marco Silva. I mean, presumably there are some you're more in synchronization with than others.
Yeah, I suppose some managers you suit their style of play more than others. That's just natural. Obviously, Slav's was probably the biggest impact on my career at the time. Like, there was a kind of a turning point. I was like 24, 25, whatever it was. It was probably the kickstart of me playing top football in the Championship and getting a very, very good team for the Championship. I think that was Fulham's turning point as well, really. I mean, they got relegated from the Premier League, had a couple of seasons, and then we started to kick on.
And when a new manager comes in, presumably within a camp, there are those that see it as an opportunity and those that might see it as a threat. So what's the captain's role when a new manager comes in?
Just to keep standards, I think. Obviously, some players will be upset that the old manager's left. Some people might be delighted. You know what I mean? It's no different to any normal job. If the boss leaves, some people might have got on with him, some people might not as much got on with him. He might have played some people or left people out. And then it's like a clean slate for everyone. I think the captain's role is just to keep standards, keep everyone's morale a little bit, and you know what I mean? And then concentrate on yourself as well, because nothing's assured for you either. But yeah, I've played under a few managers in my career. So it's nothing new really.
Yeah. Can I ask you about Rhys Porter? For anybody that doesn't know his story, he's a kid with cerebral palsy. He was mocked on social media. The club have kind of taken him to the bosom of the squad, given him a squad number. There's been very high profile goal celebrations where he's been spotted in the crowd and everybody's piled in. How important a message does that send to society, that intolerance is not acceptable in the current day and age, let alone the care that it offers to Rhys?
Yeah, massive. I mean, I wasn't in the squad for the Bristol game where we scored and everyone went over to him, which I'd have loved to have been in that moment, because that was arguably one of the moments of the season up to yet, to be honest. I just think it's vital that he got our support from what he went through, and do you know what I mean? He's trying to do amazing things, and even in the situation he's in. And I mean, when he came to the training ground and he met Tim Ream and stuff like that, it was just amazing for him and his family. We all went to see him. I feel like, yeah, in society now, I feel like, do you know what I mean, we need moments like that. And yeah, he inspires us as much as we inspire him.
Do the players talk about this kind of stuff a lot.
When he was here, we spoke about it. Yeah, we did speak about it in the daytime. He was really, do you know what I mean, he was just how happy he was in his face was crazy. And how much Fulham means to him, how much the players mean to him is quite. We don't get to see that really. Honestly, we don't really get to see that on a day to day basis. We come training, we drive home. So for him to be like he was a breath of fresh air.
Brilliant. What's your biggest fear for the rest of the season, Tom?
Not to get promoted.
What do you think might derail you from here? I know we're only at nearly the halfway point of the season, but what do you think might undermine you?
Overconfidence, not hitting the same standards as we have done that's got us in this position. But at the same time, with the manager we've got and the staff we've got, I think that'll be hard to do, if you know what I mean. He won't let that happen. But yeah, my biggest fear really is not reaching our goal.
Yeah. Are there characteristics you can spot in this season which are similar to the previous two promotions you were part of?
Yes, but I feel like we're scoring more goals. I feel like we are scoring a lot of goals. We look a constant threat. And you could say the second time we got promoted, we wasn't as attacking or free-flowing. I mean, we used to win by one goal, maybe two. We've won by a few, quite a lot this season. I think we scored 50 goals already. So I'd probably say it's more like the first time we got promoted with Slavs, as in how attacking we've been.
Yeah. I was just checking the table as you said that to see how good your maths was, and you're absolutely spot on. Must be wonderful when you are part of a squad, well, obviously now, but, you know, when you are on the kind of roll you were when you banged those seven consecutive victories together, that in stark contrast to the downside of the game you felt last season, it must be wonderful to be sort of, you know, on the sort of run that you are on.
It is. I mean, there's nothing like winning in football. I mean, to win seven games in this league, honestly, on the balance is not easy. I mean, it shows we drew the last three. Yeah, we've had a virus and through the camp and people playing, honestly, not nowhere near 100% fit, but win seven in a row is a big, big thing. And I think that catapults us to the top of the league.
Great to talk to you. Good luck for the rest of the season.
Thank you, mate. Take care.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
As part of the EFL's Rainbow Laces activities period, which runs from the 26th of November to the 13th of December this year, the league and its clubs have once again been showing their support with rainbow-coloured corner flags, nets and captain's armbands and wider LGBTQ plus inclusion activity. In addition, the EFL this week hosted its very first LGBTQ plus fans forum, an interactive virtual event where Sky Sports' Mark McAdam was joined by panellists from clubs, fan groups and stakeholders. And on the panel was the EFL's newly appointed head of equality, diversity and inclusion, David McArdle. And I guess my first question for you, David, is how this becomes a speciality from your personal point of view. What was your route to getting to this point?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, thanks very much for having me on the podcast. And my journey is probably very typical of many within the football industry when we move into ED&I. And I was a balls, bibs and markers coach. That's what I'm educated in. That's what my degree's in. And I thought my journey was going to be about creating players to play for Scotland, which is where I'm from. And I worked with the likes of John McGinn, Kenny McLean, Stevie Marlin when I worked at St Mirren. But I had a kind of epiphany moment, and I was coaching in America over a summer, and I was working with this young child, and they provided, the mum provided me with a letter when I was leaving at the end of the week. And that letter explained that her son had lost his father in a tragic accident, and he was 8 years old. And he really became very insular, very much in himself. And she said that the week that he'd spent with me and the coaching that we had done and the interaction he had with the kids in the camp, she's seen a different version of her son. She's seen the version of her son that he was before his father had passed away. And at the end of this handwritten letter, it said, people are put on this planet to do certain things. This is what you're meant to do. And at 19 years old, that changed my ethos on football. I always thought football was about winning. It was about the challenges, about getting better. It was about that kind of that part of the game. And really, I very quickly realised that's got nothing to do with it. It's all about the change that we can have in people's lives. And from that moment at 19, for the next 15 years, I've pretty much concentrated my life on equality work. I've worked in girls and women's football, youth development, para football or disability football, and then the wider equality remit during my time with the Scottish Football Association and the 15 years I spent there. So really, that's where how I ended up in this kind of specialist role within football. And it's very much just that changing of mindset that really came from it.
Yeah, except that it's not unrelated, is it? Because you mentioned the word nurturing, I think, when you were talking about working with the players. So there's a definite connection there.
Oh, yeah, there's a definite connection. I think it's just sometimes we forget the real basis of what football is, and we forget about the friendships we create, forget about the opportunities that were given to us. And as I said, as a young player myself, it was all just about winning. It was all about trying to get better. It was that element. I kind of forgot about the friendships. I forgot about the lessons that I had learned during football that I just took for granted. And sadly, some of the experiences that I've had in the game are not always the experiences that everybody else has. And that's very much in the last 15 years where I've kind of really changed my mindset and how my career's kind of blossomed during that time.
So listen, inclusion is obviously a hot potato at the moment. I'd like to think most organisations around the country and a lot around the world are genuine in their interest in doing better. Where do you think the game is at the moment, football in general?
I think what we've probably seen in the game, there's been a lot of strides taking place. We've done a lot of good things, but we've still got a lot more to do. We still need to make the game more inclusive. We still need to have better communication and better conversations. And we have done a lot. There's a lot of fantastic work being done at clubs, being done in leagues, being done in organisations around the UK, but we still have more to do. We still have a lot more to make sure that we have a game that we are feeling that it's as inclusive as it can be. And we might never reach that point, but certainly we've seen a lot of progress, but we've still got a lot of progress to go.
So to that end, where does something like the Rainbow Laces campaign fit in? Is this about awareness raising? Is that its primary function?
The Rainbow Laces campaign ultimately is an opportunity for us to have a conversation, to raise awareness to the game. Now, what we have done with the Fans Forum is we've wanted to take that more than just an awareness raising opportunity and actually change the environment, not just keep on talking about Rainbow Laces, but to actually make physical and real and effective change to what LGBTQ plus people see our game, have access to our game, and have the same opportunities. And that's really what we wanted to move the conversation forward during the Fans Forum.
I mean, do you find this is a subject that people are fearsome of, that people are in the main still uncomfortable about talking about? Not necessarily because they have any particular biases, but perhaps because they're just frightened of putting their foot in it, of saying the wrong thing, of being shot down in flames.
That's exactly it. When people are fearful of something, they're more likely not to do anything about it at all. It's the old adage, you don't go into the haunted house, you don't go into it because you're scared of it. That's why you don't do it. And a lot of the times, people don't want to raise their voice, don't want to speak out, don't want to challenge because they're worried if they say the wrong thing, if they say the wrong acronym, if they say the wrong word, that might then get them into trouble, might offend somebody. And what we really need to do is to try and change that, try and change and make sure the education's there. And the more we talk about it, the more influence we can have on people and the more comfortable that they feel about using certain words or using certain phrases that allow us to have that opportunity. And really, every conversation we have is an opportunity to educate and break down some of those barriers and just make people feel more comfortable so they can have meaningful conversations throughout our game.
Yeah, I guess we learn through making mistakes as well, don't we? As I said, probably the only concern would be that somebody might be fearful of actually participating in the conversation because they're so frightened of repercussions in their own life. Because that is a big part of life at the moment, David, isn't it? You know, we do have a culture where people strike on the smaller elements and don't necessarily look at the big picture.
Yeah, I think everybody knows the words that when we talk about equality as a general subject, there's certain words that everybody should know is unacceptable use of language. We all know who they are and we don't need to go over them. But if somebody makes a genuine mistake and then when they realise they made the mistake, they apologise for it, then generally the communities that we work with will be understanding and see it as an opportunity to engage, to have a conversation, to educate somebody. So very, very rarely should we make a mistake in language that we don't already know we shouldn't be saying. And that's yeah. really important that we just ensure that within our environment we create safe places that can allow people to grow and develop.
Yeah. What did you learn as a result of holding this first LGBTQ plus fans forum? And what were the stories that had a particular resonance with you?
What it showed during the event is the vast amount of work that's been taking place, the vast amount of good, strong, positive environments that we are creating, that the change of culture, which is showing across the EFL, that we have got a very strong base that we want to take this new stage of our journey forward in. And when you see clubs the likes of Swansea creating merchandise for a Pride merchandise that engages and creates more visibility, when you work and talk to the Football Supporters Association and understand the amount of work and the amount of fans out there who just want to have that commonality and use football as such a powerful tool, we have got a phenomenal opportunity within the EFL. We cover 72 communities across England and Wales. So we have the opportunity not just to change the football environment, but to change the societies that within there, because ultimately when football speaks, people ultimately listen across this country, and it's vital that we use that in a powerful way.
Are there examples? I mean, you know, we've probably all heard one or two comments at football matches, but it seems to have been buried under all the talk about race of late. But would you say around the EFL stadiums, people are still using people's gender, people still using people's sexuality as a stick to beat them with?
Well, I think that's why the EFL, we undertook one of the biggest fan engagement surveys when we were looking at how we moved forward the conversation. And that's why we created Together Against Discrimination, because there is more than racism out there. There is misogyny, there is ableism, there is homophobia that still affects our clubs at this moment in time. So we need to address that. We can't just allow ourselves to consider one aspect of the challenge ahead to allow us to move forward in the journey. And it is one of these things I'll always go back and say it. Education is the biggest tool that we have to make sure people understand what these words mean. They shout these words from the stadium, they say these words in society, and they maybe don't realise the impact that has on the younger generation, somebody who's sitting beside them who may be fearful of coming out, worried about how it's going to be perceived by a family member. And if we can educate and make sure people understand that the power that some of these words have that may affect somebody, then we have the opportunity to try and change mindsets, trying to change environments. Because ultimately, I always go back on that people are good. Sometimes they just don't understand how their actions can impact on others. And if they did, they'd probably think twice about doing that.
Is there a shortage of figureheads? Because we had Ryan Atkin, the referee, on at this time last year on the Official EFL podcast, and his story brought the challenges to life. It was a very courageous story. But are we still caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, which is, while there are these biases, and football in particular is still very reticent, certainly on the male side of the game, about coming out, it makes spreading the word harder because there aren't enough figureheads to bring people's challenges to life.
I certainly think that what we need is allies. Now, Rainbow Blades, who are obviously the Sheffield United LGBTQ plus fans group, talked very passionately about the allyship. It shouldn't be just on the LGBTQ plus community to raise this message, to stand up and challenge it. It needs everybody to challenge it. And that's with, if you're sitting in the stadium and you hear words being asked and you may not be gay yourself, then challenge it. Tell somebody that that's not acceptable. Be that ally, support. And Rainbow Laces doesn't need to just be celebrated by the LGBTQ plus community. It's for everybody to celebrate, to raise that awareness, to raise that education. So would it be more beneficial if we had a player within the EFL who's came out? Maybe. But it's certainly not going to be something that we're going to be seeing that's a target for us as an organisation that we want to see. What we want to see is a changing in environment, culture and support. So if a player ever chooses to come out and kind of take that step as a personal and private decision, that everything is in place, that they feel that they have the opportunity to do that. And that's really what our main aim is to do across the EFL.
You just mentioned targets. Are you willing to share with us what's on the top of your to-do list at the moment, what your sort of top 3-5 priorities are?
I've been in the role now for 4 weeks, and one of the biggest things that we need to do is...
Did I talk about put you on the spot then?
It's consultation. It's speaking to people. We don't know what people's experiences are within the game. And fans forums are a fantastic way to listen, to find out what is the challenges, what do people want to see the change in our game and in our quality landscape. And we will do that consistently through this message, because me as an individual, I don't know what it's like for a woman to attend a football match because I've not lived their life. I don't know what it's like for somebody from the LGBTQ plus community to attend a football match because it's not been my life. So I need to listen. I need to be educating myself in every conversation I have that allows us to develop our future, to develop our strategy across the ED&I space. We also need to fully understand exactly what our clubs are doing in this area, what different community projects are taking place, what different fan groups, what different aspects that their club have, so we can create that and take that knowledge base to then share across the game, so we can make sure that fan groups are being created in a way that's sustainable and effective across our game. And that's really one of the main things. And the EFL are committed to talk to fans. We undertook an ED&I review before I was appointed to allow us to understand where we need to improve across the game. And that's vital for us to move forward. But we will always talk as much as we can to ensure that when we put something out there, that the communities that we're trying to engage with support it and back it as much as they can.
It's part of the appeal from your own point of view of taking this role with the EFL. You mentioned the sort of geographical diversity. There's a real opportunity with 72 clubs from Sunderland and Carlisle in the severe norths to Gillingham and Plymouth in the severe souths, and every shape, shade, size of city, of town in between. There's a real opportunity here, isn't there, to affect society?
Well, that's it. There's no league in the world who has the size and the breadth of communities that we have at the EFL. We have an opportunity through not just 72 clubs, but 72 communities to really make a change because, as I said before, when football speaks, people listen. And if we have that 72 unique voices around the country, we have that opportunity to really make a change, not just within the grounds, but within society and with everything that we can do. And that was one thing that obviously was brought to my attention when moving forward with the EFL, but also just the vision that the senior leadership have made with the Together Against Discrimination, that we are going to challenge us not just on one front, but on all fronts. And then looking at the fact of the consultation and the creating of that kind of campaign, the foresight as an organisation to undertake a really in-depth review into the ED&I practices shows the fact that we want to make a change. We want to be best in class when it comes to ED&I, and really shout about that to make sure that we can spread the message, to light the fire under other communities, to share that to other sports, other nations, to try and be the best as we can, not just as the EFL, but to support the journey of everybody else.
I love listening to how passionate you are about this subject. Nice to talk to you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
And if you missed the Rainbow Laces Fans Forum and you'd like to watch it back, it's available now on the EFL's YouTube page. That is it for this episode. A big thank you to Dave McCardle and Tom Kearney. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement, thanks very much for listening. Join us again soon for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.